content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or printed impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. I'll begin today with a story from the fiction section of the June 2nd, 2025 issue of the New Yorker, Love of My Days by Louise Erdrich. This happened on the Table Flat Plains before most farms had telephones. So these incidents came about because news traveled slow. Early one morning, Jake Weir went to town to see about a mixture of grains for his horses. When he returned to his farm and went into the house, he saw a stranger sitting at his table. "What are you doing here?" Both men said this at the same time. "Well, this is my house," said Weir. "You are mistaken," said the stranger. "I must ask you to leave," said Weir. "Well, you're the one who should leave." "Well, I guess I'll have to go back to town and get the sheriff then." "Well, go get him. I don't care." The man stood up. He wasn't large or threatening, or red-haired or dark-haired or blonde. Everything about him was middling. Hair, height, face, age. Weir was confused by the man's unusual conviction, though. He half believed that the man did own the place, although he himself had bought it the previous year. Yet, maybe there was some odd reason that the man had a claim. Weir got back in his good old black buggy and turned around. So responsive were his two horses that he barely needed to shift his grip on the reins. He made good time and easily located the sheriff, who was at the courthouse in the presence of a judge. Weir explained the predicament, found he was in the right, and proceeded to obtain a warrant for eviction. Sheriff Flower and Deputy Otto Poneth drove out to Weir's farmstead, with Weir following along in his buggy. By then, a thin, wet snow was coming down. As they entered the yard, the front door of the house gaped open, but when the horses stopped, the door swung shut. The men climbed down off their rigs, and Sheriff Flower approached the house. "May I come in and dry my feet?" he asked. "There's no place in here to dry your feet," was the reply. "Well, then," said Flower, "I want to feed my team." "Go to the stable and feed your team. I don't care." Both men listened hard on either side of the door. "I know who you are," said the voice from inside at last. "You're Flower, the sheriff." "Well, who are you?" Flower asked. Something in the sheriff's tone deeply aggravated and frightened the man behind the door. "I am John Timble," the voice wavered, then gathered. "I am above the state. I am a detective, a Pinkerton." "All right, John, come out," said Flower. He lifted his revolver and stepped warily off the porch. Out John came with a rifle on his hip. He pulled the trigger, then dropped the gun as if in alarm. The sheriff's death was swift, but not instantaneous. He still had time to fire. Later on, it was found that Flower's bullet had struck Timble's hand, which would have thrown off the murderer's aim if Timble hadn't fired in that deadly instant in which one man has desperate certainty and owns surprise. The shot startled Weir's team of horses, and they veered in unison toward the barn. Attempting to vault onto the driving seat, Weir went headfirst onto the buggy box so that his legs were pumping in the air. The man, who thought he was above the state, retrieved the rifle and fired shots at Weir's legs, sending bullets through his overshoe and cuff. The buggy stopped before a fence. Up came John Timble. "Get out. I just want the team." The murderer jumped onto the seat, taking up the reins as he covered Weir with the rifle. Weir pushed himself out of the buggy and stepped away, looking not at the rifle, but at his two horses. Timble drove around the yard once, and Weir watched the killer closely as he made off with the horses. At last, the man knew what he was doing. Weir and Poneth ran to help Sheriff Flower, but found that there was no life in him.
"What are we to do now?" said Poneth.
"Well, you're the deputy," said Weir.
He went into the house and took the quilt off his bed. The two men carried Flower to the sheriff's wagon, his body sagging dreadfully between them. They hoisted him into the wagon bed, and Weir covered him with the quilt. The men tried to hurry to town to sound the alarm, but Flowers' spooked and jangled horses seesawed back and forth. The left horse just wanted to shamble along, while the right horse pulled with frantic jerks. They weren't even the same size. Weir was in the back with the body. His teeth rattled, and he felt as if his head were going to burst. He kept tucking the quilt down over Flower's face. He did this tenderly. He'd stood with Flower a few years before when a certain town element had tried to oust him, and now Flower had given his life in an encounter that seemed pointless and altogether Weir's fault. He might have done a better job than Poneth with the driving, but he couldn't leave Flower. It took them nearly a full hour to travel the 7 miles, and a bit more time for Poneth to get straight the wording of the alert. John Timble has killed Sheriff Flower and is running fugitive. Take him alive or dead. He is known to be armed with. Here, Poneth consulted Weir, whose weapon in Timble's hand had killed the sheriff, a .38 caliber Winchester. He has plenty of ammunition, Weir added, thinking of recent purchases he'd left in the kitchen, heat coming to his face, and the fastest driving team in the whole damn county. His team consisted of the best possible combination, a mare and her foal, now a 4-year-old gelding. He'd got the mare at auction for a song, no, a short tune. No one had known what she was, but Weir had seen it. Quarter horse, Mustang, and possibly Morgan. Dark and wonderful. The 4-year-old had a dim white streak down its back. The mare was persnickety sometimes, but her offspring always steadied her. They ran in balance and paced themselves to any deficiency in the other's mood. He'd trained them up until their gaits were matched so perfectly that sometimes he had trouble breathing for the joy. Weir was sick about the sheriff, no question, but now the undertaker had him and there was nothing to be done. He turned his attention to what had happened and was glad the murderer, who'd been wearing Weir's best hat, his blue shirt, and his other jacket, hadn't killed him, too. However, he was beginning to regret not putting up a struggle when the man took the reins into his hands. He kept thinking back to how Timble had circled the yard before pulling onto the road. The murderer had a light and certain touch with the horses and drove pretty well, considering he'd just ended a sheriff's life. Scores of men posseed up when they got the alert. Some on horses, some in wagons. Some marched back and forth in front of their houses and farms. It was a cold December afternoon, and it would be a cold night for those patrolling the roads and crossings, but a warm night for John Timble. 10 days after H.W. Cherian moved his family onto a farmstead south of Tabor, he had heard someone drive into the yard. H.W. had been putting in order his request for a bank loan, while his wife, Carlette, finished up a bit of midnight baking. Holding a kerosene lamp, he opened the kitchen door and spoke to a well-mannered man who had become lost in his quest to find a nearby farm. The man stepped down from the buggy with a pleasant gesture. "I can sleep with my team in the barn if you'd give us shelter and a little food," said the man. "John Timble." He held out his hand for a shake. "My hope is that we might be neighbors." H.W. did not know the farm the man said he was looking for, but explained that he'd been there only a short while. "Luck upon you," said Timble. Cherian thanked him. "A man can make a lot of money," Timble observed. "Looks like you did pretty well for yourself," said H.W., shining the lamp on the good buggy and handsome team. "So I have," said Timble. They walked into the house, and Timble nodded to Carlette. She noted that his hat and jacket were good, but his trousers and shoes worn out. She recognized the farm he'd spoken of as the one her family had once owned, belonging now to someone named Weir. "Torn on a rough board," said Timble, opening his palm. Carlette went to her cupboard and found a clean rag to use as a bandage and a tot of whiskey to give the man and to wash out the injury. She knew who the man was. Knew a bullet furrow when she saw one. The house had no phone. Whatever trouble there was, she could ignore for now. So she gave him the last of the chicken. It was a thick piece of chicken, tender and well-cooked, sandwiched between two generously buttered slices of hot bread. That night, John Timble slept well on the hard kitchen floor, with a throbbing hand and the rifle beneath his blanket, but also with a warm place in his belly and the scent of still cooling bread around him. The next morning, he helped H.W. care for his stock and accepted Carlette's invitation to stay for breakfast with the family. "I know how you like your eggs cooked," she told Timble. The two children were setting plates down on the table. At their mother's words, they spun toward her, not wondering how she could already know how their guest might like his eggs, but mute with disappointment that he had been offered the eggs. Timble cast his gaze down, hid his smile. "I don't need an egg," he said. He'd found out, while helping with the chores, that a slaughtering weasel had got into the henhouse through a crack. In the heat of its bloodlust, the weasel had killed the entire flock. The hens now existed in jars, packed and canned on a cellar shelf. Soup from the carcass of the one chicken that the family had spared itself bubbled on the stove. He could smell it. But eggs were few anyway in December, and eggs there would be no more. "I will eat an egg soon enough," thought Timble. Now, the scent and sizzle of salt pork filled the house, and soon large pieces of bread fried in the fat appeared. There was also porridge and strong hot coffee. Timble thought of the blood that had bloomed on the sheriff's chest, and he asked for another cup. He drank that down. "I must leave now," he said. He put coins from his inner vest into the children's hands, then picked up the rifle. "I was cornered, but I am no killer," he thought, as he and the farmer, new to the area, walked out. The problem now was that he'd got himself too far south, instead of heading west toward the Coteau. The problem also was that there'd been a new snow, and he was easy to track. The problem, for a while, was that he kept losing his grip on his thoughts. He'd worked on these farms when they had belonged to other men. He'd worked any job he could find, and secured wealth for the landowners. After felling trees in northern Wisconsin, he had suddenly hopped a train back to this valley where he'd spent the ardor of his youth. His ideas were jumbled. He'd slept cold in camps near the railroad with the hobos and the Yeagers until he became a Yeager, too. After he'd arrived in the valley, he had found himself walking to the first farm he knew, and then the next one, and the next in this limitless place. He hoped that the sheriff, whom he'd noticed buying licorice drops just the other day, wasn't mortally hurt. The men took care with the buggy. As H.W. Cherian stroked the mare, he noticed the new tack. "These horses are gorgeous," he said. They stood back to admire their rich depth of brown. Had Cherian lived there even a few more weeks, he would have known who had reared and trained the team. Timble nodded his thanks, gathered up the reins, and swept his finger from his forehead to say goodbye. And all the while, he and H.W., still warm from their breakfast, were being watched by two very cold men. Weir and his friend Hartig were hiding a couple of hundred yards beyond the farmstead. They had been out all night tracking the murderer. Just an hour ago, Weir had recognized the marks of his own buggy wheels and the shoes on his horses. From a stand of trees on the east edge of the farm, they were waiting to get the jump on Timble. Weir had watched the killer lead his horses to the buggy. To his satisfaction and relief, he saw Timble harness the team back in the same position as the day before. By this, he knew the man didn't want to monkey with the setup. That was the satisfaction. The relief was because the gelding's distinction was a paddle foot. In the wrong position, he might have cut his mother's foreleg in a wild chase, should such an awful situation come about. Weir prayed it would not. He breathed fervently, trying to calm himself. He and Hartig were armed only with revolvers. They meant to stop Timble as he passed them if he set out east. To their intense disappointment, Timble headed west. The two men rolled into the farmyard and told the family about the killed sheriff and the stolen team. H.W. was aghast. stood outside slapping his arms as the men drove off after Timble. As Carlette well knew, a bullet had made a deep groove in the outlaw's palm. His was a hand thickened by labor, but his control of the horses and even his aim could still be spoiled. She went back to her wash. Even after it was all over, she didn't tell anyone what she knew, especially not her husband, who'd failed to repair the hen house when they moved in. She didn't tell her children either, but she did tell her grandchildren. They asked her to tell them many times, in fact, about the murderer who'd worked on her father's farm and who, the next time she saw him, ate the last of the weasel-killed chicken in a sandwich. She told how, the next morning, he had refused the eggs and given the children, who became their parents, coins. Carlette knew how he'd earned the coins, or used to earn them. He had kept stock, pitched hay, plowed, managed the threshing teams, dug a well that had collapsed and nearly killed him. It had seemed, from his matched horses and nice shirt, that he'd come up in the world, and she was sorry that that was not true. "Why did I say that I was a Pinkerton man?" Timble asked himself this question when he noticed the wagon following. "Why did I say that I was above the state?" Those words had sounded fine and strong, but they had belonged to a different man. A man who would take offense at the sheriff's reedy voice. No more than that. Timble's dry fury had grabbed him like a hungry spirit. In fact, he had been very hungry at the time. Now he was well fed. The wagon behind him dropped away. The road flowed along like milk pouring from a jug. He forgot what he had done. The packed snow was hard and clean, lightly dusted over. The sun was brilliant and mild on the western hills, where hardly anybody lived except Sioux Indians. Timble started thinking that he didn't want to creep up on Indians. Eventually, he turned around. He headed back toward the men who were hunting him. Every town and most farms along the way now had the alert. Farmers were up in their windmills and atop their barns and in other spots of vantage, scouting for Timble. Men were out with every variety of weapon. They were swarming along the border between Wakazanta and White Rock. A man named Budak stopped the wagon that Weir was driving and threw his carbine rifle to Hartig. "Let's keep our heads," said Weir, alarmed. "Don't go blasting away around my horses." "Don't worry," said Hartig. "Let me take your place," said Budak to Weir. "No." Budak reached up with his powerful, skinny arms, grabbed Weir's jacket, and wrenched him off the seat. Hartig snatched up the reins, putting down the rifle. Then Budak vaulted on in Weir's place, yelling, "Get! Get!" He found the whip and used it, so that Hartig was hard put to steady the wagon. Budak picked up the rifle. He had seen Timble driving toward the crossing just ahead. The horses jumped forward. Weir ran behind the wagon. From a distance, he saw his buggy and horses with Timble driving make the crossing and heard the shooting start. "Must be that I killed Flower," thought Timble. Now he was traveling along the snow-blown fields past little outcrops and section roads. Again, he left behind the wagon that was after him and enjoyed the flow of peace along the reins. There'd never been anything like this before in his life, and he didn't want it to end. Therefore, he hadn't stopped when he saw men along the road trying to flag him down. He'd just sailed through the crossing and over the frozen sloughs beyond. He hadn't thought why, but as soon as the wagons drew near again, he knew. Hanging was not for a man such as himself. He was meant to drive marvelous creatures, and not yet had he asked of them the utmost. Once the shooting started up, however, he slapped the reins down lightly and thrilled to the heat of power in his hands. The horses were flying like hawks, and he knew this country well, having worked these farms. If he could shake his pursuers again, he wanted to visit the rolling country and small rivers just east of White Rock. He wanted to see the tall winter jackrabbits bouncing across the snow. The road faltered, and he let the horses pick their way along. He'd make up the distance, he believed, and if cornered again, he still had time to kill himself. Budek did the shooting and used his cavalry rifle. He'd been 17 years old, serving during the last of the Indian Wars. He'd considered himself afraid of nothing, though to tell the truth, he'd only guarded starving stragglers and left when the Buffalo soldiers turned everything upside down. When they relieved his company down in Sistan, he'd quit. Since that time, decades had passed, and he'd tried everything he could think of to get a job as sheriff or deputy sheriff or any kind of official in any town at all. But people had turned away, as if there were something about him. It was not until he threw down Weir and leaped up beside Hartig that he got his chance. He would do anything to bring down a criminal. He was furious that they'd let the man skim by. It nearly maddened him. He tried to hang on and kept shooting, reloading, shooting, whether or not he was in range. Hartig side-eyed him and told him to settle. There was rough road ahead, and they gained ground on the buggy. At one point, Weir's horses had to turn nearly sideways on the broken path. Budak had the rifle on his shoulder in that moment. He took the shot, and to bring down his man, he aimed for the horse. "Why haven't they managed to shoot me yet?" Timble puzzled as he went off on foot, walked and ran, stopping occasionally to try to kill the man who had jumped down to pursue him. Budak was an eager devil. He'd even fired a bullet that grazed Timble's scalp and knocked him down for a moment. Timble entered the big White Rock ravine with plenty of ammunition. The trees were glowing with hoarfrost down there, picked out golden by the low rays of sunlight. He'd got hauled out of caved earth once and went from dead to living. The years since had been gravy. Oh, it was good to be above ground. Today was like one of those dances he'd been at from time to time, where just when you mean to leave, the music and the lights pick up. But you can't stay. Someone is waiting, he thought. I know what I had. Milk pouring from a jug. I will never have the like of that drive again. I know these farms. Ate well in my life. I've had no complaint except for want of land. Yet that bread. And also yet, who would take such an evil shot? Horses pull for each other, and he could see the one on the left was bred from the one on the right and made no call to shoot a son's mother. A soundless drench of colors smote Timble. Once the tack and harness were untangled, the son lifted himself away from his mother. He stood alone as he was being rubbed dry with hay. When half of you is gone, the half left behind begins its long descent into a cold, strange barn. No matter how warm you get, you are never warm, and no matter how much you eat, you are never full. You are out of harness, but somehow pulling the entire weight. At least the authority came to him. Cradled his jaw, kept running the brush along his back, made the sounds they make when they must stand up to a loss. It wasn't enough, but the man stayed near and made noises. Why if only, and why, and if only, why? All sorts of nonsense, and gave shape to the suffering. After the colors cleared away, Timble was surprised to see Beatrill walking toward him over the snow. She was wearing her summer dress of rose pink with tiny checks. Her sleeves were rolled up over her strong, tanned forearms, and she was wiping her hands on her apron, as if she'd just washed them. She was walking quickly, purposefully, but not running. So he didn't think that he'd been hit very badly. Her brown hair was loose, as if she'd just washed that, too. Her hair was blowing about her shoulders, and as she got near to him, she smiled. "I see your sister this very morning," he said to her. As if this were an ordinary meeting, she made an exasperated face that was nonetheless full of love. Her fractious sister, Carlette, had been a favorite of their conversation. Each of the daughters had a name that began with the letters of the name their father had chosen.
upended by the letters that their mother had insisted upon. Beatrille was the oldest, then Nantive, and at last Carlette. The farm had failed 3 years in a row, and they had moved to town, renting out the house and land, leaving Timble to hunt down jobs and hop trains to follow the harvest. He'd got stuck in Nebraska. Upon his return, he found that Beatrille had contracted typhus and died of it. He walked back to the train and kept moving. East, west, and of course, south down Harvest Corridor. How the years passed. The things he'd seen and done. But he remembered best the year that he and Beatrille found that she was for him and he was for her. He'd remembered everything times over, bucking along in boxcars. How they'd shared a jug of ginger water in the heat of the day. How she took off her apron and laid out a picnic of bread and apples. Before he left, they lay down in the brittle yellow grass and watched grasshoppers spring from tip to tip above their heads. In the peace of early twilight, they had turned to each other. "Love of my days," he had said it to her then, and he said it to her now. Someone's boots squeaked on the snow. Budak loomed over them, his revolver out. Kneeling beside Timble, Beatrille grasped his hand and said, "Don't mind him." And now, from the April 28, 2025 issue of the New Yorker, was the Civil War inevitable? Before Lincoln turned the idea of the Union into a cause worth dying for, he tried other means of ending slavery in America, by Adam Gopnik. Out of guilt or amnesia, we tend to treat wars in retrospect as natural disasters. Terrible, but somehow inevitable, beyond anyone's control. Shaking your fist at the fools who started the First World War and condemned millions to a meaningless death seems jejune. Historians teach us to say that the generals did their best under impossible conditions. Mournful fatalism is the requisite emotion, even when mad fury would be more apt. Efforts at de-escalation are cast as weakness or cowardice, while those who lead nations into catastrophe are praised for their strength of character or for stoically accepting what was supposedly unavoidable. We rarely honor those who turn back at the brink. John F. Kennedy's compromise during the Cuban Missile Crisis is an exception, though only because prudence and caution, our removal of nuclear missiles from Turkey, were neatly covered up and presented as pugnacity and courage. We had made the Russians blink. The habit of describing war with metaphors drawn from natural disasters is as old as war writing. Homer himself uses natural metaphors to ennoble violent human actors. Achilles is a wildfire sweeping across the Trojan plain. Given what Greek warfare actually entailed, pitched battles of close combat where victory meant cutting others to death with edged weapons, the figure feels less like a metaphor than a mask. So it is with us. The Civil War lingers in memory as brutal and heartbreaking, but also as heroic and tragic, accompanied by an Appalachian campfire fiddle. It is the altar of American existence, a sublime sacrifice and a perpetually contested example, so thoroughly sanctified that to ask if it might have been avoided by pragmatic compromise feels almost obscene. No war, no Lincoln, no Emancipation Proclamation, no Gettysburg, neither the battle nor the address to inspire and instruct us. And yet 750,000 people died, and the enslaved people in whose name the war was fought emerged still trapped in an apartheid terrorist state. Was it worth it? In 1861, The Lost Peace, published by Grand Central, Jay Winnick, the author of several fine works about American history, takes up that question of whether the Civil War might have been avoided. The title overpromises a little. Nowhere in the book do we encounter a truly plausible compromise that might have averted the conflict.
What Winnick offers instead is a portrait of two sides talking past each other rather than with each other. Still, he traces the efforts of those who genuinely wanted to prevent war and the trauma of secession, and shows how Abraham Lincoln tried at first to listen and then at last refused. The early chapters are given over to what will be for many a familiar story. We hear again how an underrated, grotesque-looking backwoods lawyer with scant experience, one term in Congress and two failed Senate runs, managed by virtue of being a moderate and usefully an outsider. A man of the frontier rather than of Boston or New York, to wrest the Republican nomination from the seemingly inevitable William Henry Seward of New York and go on to win the national election against the pro-slavery Democrat John Breckinridge. We are told about the assassination plots brewing before Lincoln had even taken office, forcing him, in ways widely seen as comical, not to say cowardly, to sneak into Washington under the protection of the newly founded Pinkerton Private Detective Force. Southern states were already passing resolutions of secession one after another, with South Carolina taking the lead. Meanwhile, the Confederate noose was tightening around Fort Sumter and the waters off Charleston, where the Northern garrison was effectively under blockade. The reasons for the radical action were plain. Lincoln, despite his efforts to present himself as a moderate, was what we should now call a single-issue candidate. The issue was slavery and his categorical rejection of it. If slavery is not wrong, nothing is wrong, was his most emphatic aphorism on the subject, along with his famous injunction, "A house divided against itself cannot stand. I believe this government cannot endure permanently, half slave and half free." Though absolute on the moral question, Lincoln was neither the hardcore political abolitionist we may wish him to have been, nor the apologist for slavery some later commentators have made him seem. He was, instead, a Democratic politician trying to build a coalition. And he knew that, to keep the border states within it, a firm New England abolitionist line would fail, while a focus on containing slavery, not eradicating it, might succeed. And so, during that strange American interregnum between election and inauguration, it was even longer in the 19th century, with the ceremony held in March, Lincoln struggled to find common ground with the Southern secessionists. He began a pre-inaugural exchange of letters with Alexander Stephens of Georgia, a friend from his congressional days who made it clear that, in the Southern mind, everything was secondary to the preservation of slavery. "We at the South do think African slavery, as it exists with us, both morally and politically right," Stephens wrote. "This opinion is founded upon the inferiority of the black race. You, however, and perhaps a majority of the North, think it is wrong. Admit the difference of opinion." The enterprise of avoiding war was likely doomed from the start. Nonetheless, and here lies the new emphasis of Winnick's book, there was an attempt at a peace conference during this pre-inaugural period, and it was more substantial than most subsequent histories have acknowledged. If it didn't resolve the crisis, it at least exposed the depth of the deadlock. The conference took place in Washington at the Willard Hotel, where Lincoln had stayed since his arrival, using his suite as his office. From February 4th to the 27th, the conference drew delegates from 21 of the 34 states then in the Union. It brought together representatives from the South, most notably from Virginia, the cradle of presidents, which had not yet committed to secession, with Republicans from the North, many of them, as Winnick reveals, operating under the direct or indirect guidance of Seward. Though the delegates were mostly former members of Congress, the gathering wasn't limited to them. The former President John Tyler of Virginia, who held no official position but remained influential, was present. It was, by all indications, a comfortable negotiation. It is perhaps not surprising, then, given their shared table, class, and manners, that both sides, including almost all the Republicans, were ready to concede the permanence of slavery in the South in exchange for ending the threat of secession. A 13th Amendment was proposed, and could probably have passed, guaranteeing the continued existence of slavery in the states where it already prevailed. Even Lincoln was prepared to accept this. The unresolvable issue was the extension of slavery into the territories. Here, the arguments were fierce, layered with subtext and overtones more audible then than now. For all the civility of tone and talk of compromise, Lincoln went so far as to agree that a fugitive slave could be recaptured and returned to bondage. The real conflict was profound and, in the end, unbridgeable. Like the conflict in the Middle East today, it was rooted less in clashing interests than in vast and irreconcilable mutual fears. The underlying meanings were evident to all. Any limit placed on slavery, the Southerners believed, was intended to hasten its extinction. Any constitutional blessing of slavery, the North understood, was intended to support its extension. Behind the Southern delegate's suspicion was a kind of post-October 7th trauma. John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry in 1859 had convinced the South that the black population was poised to rise up in bloody rebellion if given the chance. This, in retrospect, was plainly chimerical. The enslaved had not, in fact, joined Brown's insurrection, and when black enfranchisement did eventually come, however, briefly during Reconstruction, black Americans, far from turning violently on their former masters, embraced electoral politics with enthusiasm. But the Southern establishment was unshakable in its belief that any concession to abolitionists would end in the massacre of white families. Stevens wrote indignantly to Lincoln of such exhibitions of madness as the John Brown raid into Virginia, which has received so much sympathy from many, and no open condemnation from any of the leading men of the present dominant party. Lincoln nonetheless participated warmly in the peace conference debate, insisting that his task was simply to follow the Constitution, which he understood to prohibit secession from the Union as an act of treason. Yet, for all his provisional concessions, he effectively ended the conference by declaring, "In a choice of evils, war may not always be the worst. Still, I would do all in my power to avert it, except to neglect a constitutional duty. As to slavery, it must be content with what it has. The voice of the civilized world is against it." Those words may now strike us as unduly mild, but behind them lay the doctrine of the scorpion's sting. The idea adopted by anti-slavery advocates around the world that if slavery could be encircled and confined, it would destroy itself, as the scorpion is said to sting itself to death when trapped in a ring of fire. Yet Lincoln's words signaled, clearly to anyone attuned to their overtones, and everyone at that conference was, that slavery was to be put, or left, in a position where it would have to end itself. Slavery had a cursed past and a present to be tolerated, but no future. No one quite said this. Everyone grasped it. And so the Willard Peace Conference quietly foundered. Its resolutions were rejected in the Senate and never even reached a vote in the House. Southern paranoia and Northern complacency together may explain what, at first glance, seems to us the oddest feature of the Willard meetings, that no one on the Northern side proposed a rational plan for gradual emancipation and enfranchisement, presumably subsidized by the already wealthy industrialists of the North and carried out over some specified interval. Such plans have been tried before, in Pennsylvania as early as the 1780s, and proposed for Virginia, though unsuccessfully, by Thomas Jefferson. Surely a similar scheme, however brutal its delay for the enslaved, might have spared the country the full scale of the war to come. Lincoln himself returned to the idea in 1862 when he proposed a program of compensated gradual abolition for the border states. Yet, even then, at the height of the war, sympathetic border state representatives refused to act. Slavery had embedded itself too deeply, not only as an economic engine, but as a terror-bound cultural institution. The tragedy was that, while the South could not overcome its paranoia about the violence it would suffer if the slaves were freed, The North could not imagine the scale of the violence it was choosing. The assumption, of course, was that the conflict would last 12 weeks, just long enough to put the erring states back in their place. But only a few months later, Julia Ward Howe would be staying at the same Willard Hotel when, in the course of a day, she saw a column of freshly inducted Union soldiers in blue uniforms marching and singing lines from a newly adapted spiritual, John Brown's body lies a moldering in the ground. The words struck her as too direct, and she composed a loftier version in her hotel room, substituting God's vengeance for that of the abolitionist. He has loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on. The battle hymn of the Republic was born. It was only November and already more than 40,000 soldiers had fallen. The eternal language of euphemism, swords, and lightning had begun its work, displacing the reality of bullets breaking bodies. In the wake of the failed conference, Lincoln skillfully replaced abolition with the Union as the war's compelling purpose. The case he made to connect the end of slavery with the preservation of a political arrangement was subtle. Secession, he maintained, was a denial of democratic rule. Slavery had, from the beginning, been a national issue. It could not be fenced off and become a parochial one now. This was the logic, easily lost to us because it's so familiar, behind the memorable line in the Gettysburg Address delivered 2 years later, that the great question of the war was whether any nation so conceived and so dedicated, that is to liberty, can long endure. Without a strong central authority, not a dictator or a king, but a unifying rule of law, a free state would be torn apart by demagogues and dissension. Yet the argument, though it has come to seem foundational, is in some ways specious. As Southern critics noted at the time, for the wrong reasons, but not with the wrong logic, the American Revolution was itself an act of secession from a functioning and successful Union. Many regions have broken apart at the will of their inhabitants. It is easy to imagine horrors today that could make, say, California and Oregon and Washington want to declare themselves a separate polity. And it is hard to invoke a moral principle to tell them that they can't. From this perspective, the idea of union was one of the most disingenuous diversions in American history. The transformation of an abstract constitutional principle into a cause worth dying for. Why this new argument proved so powerful remains something of a mystery. Edmund Wilson, in his study of Civil War literature, Patriotic Gore, saw it in the blunt, power-fixated logic of human history. Big states swallow small ones. The North was stronger and bigger, and it swallowed the South. The bleak truth, Wilson suggested, is that people like joining armies of conquest. Presumably, when the great Canadian campaign begins, there will be no shortage of soldiers to fight it, or of apologists ready to enumerate the horrors of Canadian life that must be erased, poutine aside. And yet Canada, oddly, offers a clue to the peculiar appeal of Lincoln's abstract ideal of union. Donald Trump's threats have, almost overnight, caused a famously divided and centrifugal nation to cohere into a single national front. Something like that happened across the North at the outset of the Civil War, when the Union became not just a constitutional principle, but a moral rallying cry. The South, for its part, responded in kind. Secession swiftly forged a fractured region into a reactive unity, bound by fear of emancipation and faith in a mythic agrarian freedom. This bleaker view is reinforced by the historian Michael Vorenberg's new book, Lincoln's Peace, published by Knopf, which picks up the story at the other end of the conflict, as the war was drawing to a close after unfathomable death and suffering. Vorenberg's account, despite the intervening carnage, returns us to a situation eerily similar to the one that preceded the war. The White South, though militarily defeated, had no intention of accepting anything resembling racial equality. And while Robert E. Lee might have declined to resort to guerrilla warfare, many of his lieutenants carried on a program of suppression by terror. In that sense, Vorenberg argues, the Civil War never truly ended. Lincoln's assassination was, in this light, a last-ditch terrorist assault on the national government, one that very nearly succeeded. Seward and Vice President Andrew Johnson survived the conspiracy only by chance. The pattern of compromise persisted, with the politics of the border states still exerting undue influence. Indeed, one of the most fateful disasters in American history, Johnson's embattled presidency, was a byproduct of those very compromises. Johnson, a Tennessean, was chosen to replace Hannibal Hamlin of Maine on the 1864 ticket in a bid to appease the border states, with predictable results. In American Civil Wars, published by Norton, Alan Taylor broadens the frame to include parallel struggles over national identity and democratic renewal in the 1860s, not only in the United States, but in Canada and Mexico as well. One could broaden it further and argue that the period from 1848 to 1871, bracketed by the liberal revolutions and the end of the Franco-Prussian War, was marked by a series of violent shocks across the Western world, culminating in the establishment of a liberal political compact that, in some form, endured into our own time. Lincoln's passion became so sanctified in this reading because it was the most extreme instance of a common struggle. In this view, the American experience was not exceptional, but emblematic, a subset of the painful emergence of something resembling genuinely popular democracy. What's striking about the new literature on Lincoln and the war is that, though one may expect him to be in some sense debunked or deconstructed, he remains a largely idealized figure. Winnick is admiring of its firmness of purpose at the war's outset. Vorenberg mourns its absence at the war's end. Matthew Stewart, in his recent study of the influence of idealist philosophy on abolitionism and emancipation of the mind, goes further. Drawing on quotations from Karl Marx, a Lincoln enthusiast, Stewart argues that Lincoln was essentially the first Marxist president, embracing a view of labor not far from Marx's own and opposing the peonage of working people in all its forms. This is obviously tendentious, nor does Stewart mean it entirely seriously. But then Lincoln, like Jesus, is easily made to conform to whatever ideological need the historian brings to him. If a left-wing quasi-Marxist Lincoln is a plausible invention, so is a far-right conservative one of the sort invoked by Henry V. Jaffa, the godfather of the Claremont Institute. Jaffa saw Lincoln's choice of war in 1861 as wholly heroic, an almost Christ-like epiphany that united revelation and reason in a moral crusade. He cast Lincoln as the embodiment of a set of absolute values, biblical revelation and Greek reason joined in opposition to the relativism of modern liberal humanism, with its taste for irony and its acceptance of a plurality of forms of existence. Jaffa was, in effect, allying Jerusalem and Athens against New York. He wanted the American home built on rock, not shifting sand, and believed Lincoln was its carpenter. In truth, we have no difficulty building our abodes on sand. That's why the most expensive homes in Los Angeles and Long Island are called beach houses. There is no bedrock to build on in the world or in morality. The political ground beneath our feet shifts, grows squishy, and is meant to. What we feel when we study Lincoln's life through the war is not so much the force of fixed convictions imposed on others as the gradual emancipation of his own mind, a sense of his discovery in real time of what he believed. A powerful intuition that slavery was absolutely wrong evolved into a tragic fatalism, haunted by a sense of providence, and finally opened into a horizon of hope shaped by the scale of suffering Lincoln had helped to unleash. This much death had to make for a better land. Yet, believing that the war was inescapable is not quite the same as believing that it was right. Was the Civil War worth the sacrifice? Suppose that someone had had the force and the imagination to craft a plan for gradual emancipation. Full enfranchisement might have been delayed for several years, but the enslaved would have been free at last. And what of the human cost?
If 800,000 people have been deliberately murdered over the next 4 years in some expanded version of the Trail of Tears or the Bataan Death March, would we see that as an unfortunate necessity of history or as an unforgivable crime? Of course, some 800,000 did die, many in horrific ways, while the formerly enslaved were left to fend for themselves in a post-war state where apartheid was enforced by terror. Why exactly is that outcome morally preferable or more readily excused? These were not slaves, but soldiers, who in some collective sense chose to fight. But was that choice entirely their own? Or was it made for them by circumstance, by duty, by the illusions of glory, not to mention the blunt force of conscription? We are far too ready to depict the suffering of others as the price of the history that seemingly rewards us now. The truth is that we accept mass dying with enormous aplomb. More than 1 million perished in the COVID-19 pandemic. But those who complacently predicted that it would be no more than a season's pain appear to represent the new common sense. Lockdowns were excessive, the health establishment overreacted. Mass dying barely faces us until, that is, it becomes personal and particular. Leo Tolstoy revered Lincoln, calling him a, quote, Christ in miniature, a saint of humanity whose name will live for thousands of years, end quote. Yet, in War and Peace, he captures the raw vulnerability of a young soldier, brave, devoted, almost absurdly loyal to the cause and its flawed leaders, wounded in battle. As blood seeps away and he imagines death nearing, the soldier slips into a state of wonder at existence. These passages, among literature's most poignant and strangely affirming, bridge the gap between the vastness of war and the intimacy of a single death. A youth swept into combat by patriotic fervor faces bullets and, fallen, gazes at the sky, not with moral clarity or anger, but with innocent bewilderment. Existence is so good. Why am I dying for this? Major Sullivan Ballew, writing to his wife Sarah before the first Battle of Bull Run, mused, I know I have but few claims upon divine providence, but something whispers to me. Perhaps it is the wafted prayer of little Edgar, that I shall return to my loved ones unharmed. If I do not, my dear Sarah, never forget how much I love you, nor that when my last breath escapes me on the battlefield, it will whisper your name. Early in the fight, a cannonball tore off his leg. He lingered in agony for a week, very likely in no condition to whisper anything, least of all, her name. Lincoln's elegiac words about the dead soldiers at Gettysburg remain true. From their sacrifice, we still can take renewed commitment to their cause, that of liberty against tyranny. But we should also remember that the purpose of the struggle of liberty against tyranny is not to carry on the fight, but not to have to. We can't forget these soldiers' lives, but neither should we forget the manner of their dying. Even if we return to the original proposition that the Civil War was unavoidable, or that of all the bad choices, war was not the worst, it does not alter what happened at Bull Run or Antietam. Remaining alive to other people's pain in the face of heroic rhetoric, retrospective rationalization, and two-sided tribal terror is perhaps the hardest moral task we face, and one at which we almost always fail. Sometimes the only people who can see the sky are the soldiers who die beneath it. And now a poem from the June 9th, 2025 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Inquest by Ellen Bass. What did she eat for breakfast? Why were her feet so clean?
Why are the yellow irises so luscious this spring? When was the last time you touched her? Where did she stash the pills? Were there rivers in her dreams? Did she like figs, olives? Why wouldn't she cut her hair? Did she get a nose job in high school? What made her such a bad cook? What will you miss most about her? Was she breathing when they found her? Who was that married man she was once crazy about? Why was she always saying, "Don't tell anybody"? How did you disappoint her? Why did she let the chickens poop all over? Why did she stick a single gladiola in every bouquet of zinnias? Why did she finger her ailments like a rosary? Explain cosmic inconsequence. Why did she hold her fork in her fist? Why couldn't she apologize? Did she watch fog blow across the cypresses and redwoods and across the cables of the Golden Gate Bridge? Was there anyone she trusted? Would gardening have helped? She won raffles. Was she lucky? What lullaby did she sing to her baby? When she lay on the floor waiting for death, what did she think? Was she weary of clouds? How could she give up kisses? Why wouldn't she tell where she found the chanterelles? We've run out of time for today's episode of the New Yorker magazine. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. That website again is ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.